Hi, and welcome to Jolly's Fall 2020 podcast series. This is Merida Lang, the principal editor of the Journal of Language and Literacy Education, a peer-reviewed open access journal housed in the Department of Language and Literacy Education at the University of Georgia. Today, I will be speaking with Drs. Fawn Kennedy, Assistant Professor of Adolescent and Digital Literacies at Sonoma State University, Chilis E. Scott, Associate Professor of Literacy at the University of Nevada, Las Vegas, and Troy Hicks, Professor of English and Education at Central Michigan University. Their manuscript is titled Walking a Thin Line, Exploring the Tensions Between Composition Curriculum and Students' Lives as Digital Writers. Thank you for joining me today. I look forward to hearing more about your work.
Thank you for having us.
Gladly. So my first question is, how would you characterize the current state of digital literacies in schools?
I think that it's right now the current state is going to be kind of is the big question, right? One thing that I think is really interesting about the current state of digital literacies is all of these years that we've been asking teachers to get on board, everybody was forced in at the same time. And so on the one hand, I'm really surprised by all of the really creative ways that teachers have met this moment and how they're changing their instruction literally almost daily, because I supervise student teachers in the field, I'm seeing a lot of these things. And then in other ways, I can see that we had years and years of missed opportunities to really prepare teachers for this space.
I'll jump in really quick and just say that I think Fawn mentioned there are a number of innovative, creative, wonderful things that are happening. And if there's anything that, especially in the spring when restrictions on grades and expectations of a certain type of digital writing, normally the word process document with the thesis-driven essay, were kind of lifted, you saw some teachers really feel more free to explore things like infographics and digital stories and websites and things like that. And now I think, unfortunately, many have fallen back into the same ruts as expectations for grades and the normal schooling has come back. And so, one of the things I would hope to see is that as we see more and more digital literacies enacted in schools, we're less on the consumption side of things. Oh, great, I'm going to deliver another interactive slideshow using whatever tool, or I'm going to have you quickly make this one thing using this great little infographic program, but we're not really going to engage in it fully. We're just going to get it done and turn it in and be on with it. And instead, to see digital literacies really become more embedded. I know we're not at ubiquitous access yet. We probably will never be at ubiquitous access, but with most students having the most access to the most devices right now, we have a really unique opportunity to start integrating digital literacies more fully. So that's what I would like to see happen.
I think I'm kind of looking at it from a different point of view, as I see now, like Fawn said, that there was those missed opportunities, but also there's this new connection of working with one another, especially in faculty and teachers, being on message boards, asking questions, how do I do this? What's the best tool? I think that's one good thing I've seen in the past year, as those educators are rallying around each other to provide support for either teachers or educators that weren't doing things digitally yet, or those that were hyper digital, and trying to find those connections. But then the other side is the students. We have the same outcome, students that are really great with technology and using those digital literacies, and students that are still struggling to turn on the camera on during classes, whether they're young children being guided by their guardians or grandparents or teachers at home, parents at home, or you have college students. And so I think it's finding, we see the positive, but we also see, like Juan said, those gaps that we still have. But I think having the educators seeking help from one another and me being part of those boards and reading them has, at least for myself in this area, has been eye-opening. And even myself, I'm a little worried about my classes next semester. What am I going to do? What am I going to do? So keeping it innovative, but also the rigor and, like Troy said, not falling to our old ways.
You know, I think it's really highlighted, to build on what both of you said, it's really highlighted the things that we've kind of pretended have worked in in-person schooling, right? It's really kind of blown the cover, the really thin veil off of the inequities that we see, but also, like Troy mentioned, things like seat time and, you know, that we, the assumption that just because our students are in the seats in the classroom in front of us, that they're really learning. And so, you know, I think that digital literacies in schools has also really, you know, this moment has also underscored that inequity, that divide. And one of the things that we talk about in our article too is that even though our students, we assume they're digital natives, that they know what they're doing, that they're being intentional with their the use of technology. So from access all the way to that intentionality, it's just not there.
Yeah, it's a really interesting point all around, you know, and I know that both in my experience as a secondary teacher and now as a, you know, teacher of pre-service teachers, I often assume that students have at least as much knowledge as I do about technology, right? I'm like an old millennial. I assume that they know at least as much as I do. And often it's just that we know really different things, right? But to assume that our students kind of have the degree of familiarity with technology that aligns with ours is certainly, I think, an error that I make time and time again. So it's always good to be reminded not to do it. So would you mind talking a little bit about your experience with a multi-year study, which I know that this piece arises out of? So many educational researchers don't have the opportunity to engage in such a long study. So how does it differ from shorter ones or from a different sort of study that you've experienced?
You guys want me to go first again?
Whoever wants to jump in.
So one of the things about this multi-year study, I think, has a lot to do with the methodology. And so using formative experiment, or, you know, some people have called it design-based research, is more of a partnership with the educators in authentic, you know, classroom settings. And so because we had that partnership, there was some real, first it was by invitation, right? She was a teacher who, you know, even though she had this advanced placement course and she had students who were really motivated, she didn't see them as really engaged in the material, that she felt there was this big disconnect between their lived experiences and what they were learning in school. And she wanted to bring more of that, you know, multimodal composition into the classroom, but she didn't know where to start. She didn't have that knowledge. And so it was by invitation that we started this study. But then we worked together, and I think that was a really important point. We developed the intervention together with a teacher. We looked at the artifacts, you know, what students produced together, and then we made changes for the following year. And so it kind of was this, you know, exciting, you know, formative experiment allows us this space to make those changes. We're not bound to this fidelity, and risk-taking is actually a really important part of the process, as is failure, because we learn from it. And so the process of change was really important. So we started at the end of the year with this study, and then we started it at the beginning of the year because one of the things that we wanted to do was bridge those lived literacies and the academic learning that students were doing, and also kind of think about how that intersects with their identities, you know, who, how they see themselves as readers and writers in these spaces. Mm-hmm. And so after we went through that second iteration and saw what the students did and where the holes were in the intervention again after that second time and after the modifications that we made, we immediately followed, you know, formative experiment allows us to immediately follow with changes. And so we did some work with visual rhetoric and visual culture so that we could really look at the meanings that already come with all of the resources that students use in digital composing. And then the teacher dramatically, so it wasn't just the students that changed, it was the teacher also. And so she dramatically changed the way that she approached teaching, you know, this course. And then in the third year, kind of put the feelers out for other participants who taught at schools that also had a greater representation, or because we were in a really diverse school district, but the school itself wasn't as diverse as, didn't mirror the rest of the school district. So we moved into that other space. And again, because of the flexibility within a formative experiment approach, the teacher could find a space in her curriculum for the things that, the tools that we were designing and the lessons that we were thinking about. So
I think it's important to add on to what Juan is saying, especially for the multi-year, is the fact of accessibility and how important that was to gain access. But also, like she was saying, we were invited in. I remember Juan telling me, I want you to go with me to meet this teacher. So we sat down and talked to her and just said, what do you want to do? Like, what is your idea? And we just wrote down everything that we can do within that idea. But I don't even think we even hit some of them. It just continued to roll over each year. But also, it's important to mention that collaboration with that teacher and then with other teachers. But then you have the buy-in of her team and her cohort, and then other teachers within the district and within other schools that weren't part of the district learned of this project and were like, you can come to my classroom and you can work with me. But I think the big one, and it is mentioned in this article, is the administration. In the beginning, there was resistance. We had to build a relationship, and it was almost like a pilot to the pilots is what we did. And why it is multi-year, so that we could show them, like, this could be a really good project. This could really help not just this teacher and these students, but the other teachers and other students and the students to come. So I think that for the idea of this project itself and Fawn's research, it is multi-year, definitely. And I would say it also goes to the researcher to be dedicated to the project, but also to the teachers, because she was spending a lot of time in the field, a lot of time collecting data. And so I think you have to look at it from different lenses, that we had accessibility, we had partnerships, and then we had, you know, interesting results, but then also the formative design continued to show what we could do with it. And so I think that those are key components to talking about multi-year study.
I would just build on this really quickly to say that as the outside committee member who didn't actually get to visit the site or be there with Fawn doing the research, but hearing about it and watching it unfold, it really reminds me of the tenets of the National Writing Project and teacher research and what we know about job embedded, just in time, real time, purposeful learning for professionals. And so honoring the voices of teachers, working with them, recognizing that there are going to be roadblocks. There's no perfect study that's going to, you know, be, you know, I don't have this preconceived notion that this have to happen in pre and post tests and things like that. You know, without getting into this big, you know, epistemological debate about qualitative versus quantitative and the state of education and all that, I just know that my ethos, and I think all of us would share this, is that working with teachers in partnership generally leads to more substantive change in the long run. And having this opportunity to do something over a multi-year study means that those impacts will probably be felt for years beyond that.
That's always so wonderful to hear about, you know, teacher research partnerships. It's also really great to just, you know, have the space to discuss the challenges that can pop up in that, right? I feel like often we don't have the opportunity to talk about sort of how difficult it can be to get into schools and work with schools and you know, have a program that lasts for, you know, more than just a short while. So it's great to see an example of that and be able to discuss that with you. So sort of then talking about teachers in the classroom, how do you feel that teachers could, or what do you think teachers could be doing differently in classrooms in terms of digital literacies? You know, especially as we think about getting ready to make the transition back into in-person schools, which theoretically will happen within the next year. Knock on wood.
Just don't know, do we? It's a constant toggle. And in fact, just about an hour or so ago, we got the message from my own children's school district that they will be in remote learning through the holidays and will not be back in physical school until at least January. So yes, I'm gonna pick up on a theme I said earlier, and I say this again with that spirit of collaboration and being a critical friend. I think I do not want to cast a disparaging remark on all K-12 ELA teachers. And yet at the same time, I'm going to repeat that I feel that a lot of what we do is digital, is just the equivalent of, you know, a digital ditto, or we're only doing it digital because we have to, and not because we're actually embracing the full opportunities to do something with digital literacies. When you look at statements like NCTE's revised definition of digital literacy, or the ELATE subgroup, the English Language Arts Teacher Educator subgroup for digital literacies, their statement, the beliefs that came out a few years ago, and we think about what's really happening, and are we actually pushing students towards that critical, creative production, and not just... we do want them to be critical as they're consuming and evaluate their sources and make sure that they're using things in appropriate ways. But to what extent are we asking them, excuse me, to be in the creator role? And I think that's this moment again. And I'll reiterate, I know we're not at 100% access. We probably never will be. But wow, if there's any silver lining to the COVID cloud, the fact of the matter is that more kids have access to technology and the internet right now than ever before. And we really need to make that pivot. You know, we need to help ELA teachers think about pushing kids into that more productive state.
All right, Dr. Cataday or Dr. Scott, do you two have any thoughts on that?
I was waiting to see if Chilis was going to say something. I agree with everything that Troy said, and I also feel like I hear a lot of talk about getting back to normal, right? that I've really been thinking about and watching, you know, teachers of my own kids have been in remote learning since this whole thing happened. So in where we are in Northern California, we will be remote this entire year. And so also thinking about this idea, and I remember I heard a talk by Megan Bang and some other folks like Garcia and Mira, who are talking about speculative education and thinking about also how we're, like Troy said about, you know, our students are using digital tools all the time. It's just a part of the way that we communicate, and it's also kind of shaping the way that we communicate with each other, but it's not reflected in what we're doing in the classrooms. So how we can trust our own expertise in the English language arts to open that up to more collaboration with our students too, to really enlist their knowledge and their experience and trust them to, you know, fill in the gaps. So I'm reminded of when I did professional development for a large school district with educational technology, I would tell the teachers that you use your expertise, you set up this framework, but then you can rely on the students who will have different levels of expertise in different areas to really fill in those spaces for you. You can learn alongside them. And so I think what this article too does with the tensions is really highlights, like Chilla said, all of the pushback, all of the pressure that this teacher experienced. She had us there to really like keep her going, right? To give her that confidence as somebody who wasn't really sure of herself in this space, to say, keep going, you're doing the right thing, just keep going to the end. And then everybody was really happy with the outcome in that first iteration. But at first it wasn't easy, it was really hard. And I think that there's so many pressures on us to, you know, go back to normal or to teach a certain way or to keep, you know, on grade level expectations. And like Troy said, not to disparage anybody's good work. It's really hard. It's to say that it's really hard. There's so many pressures that are just not right there in the classroom.
I think it's good to build on what they're saying is, Juan has used the word compliance normal. what we don't, there isn't a normal anymore. And I would be fearful that teachers would do the 180 when they get back into the classroom. But our students that are going back in the classroom aren't those students anymore either.
Right.
So it's continuing to make those connections and letting the students' creativity come through what their experiences have been over the next last year or the next year, like whatever that may be. So I think it's also helping the teachers to continue to find that balance that helps them to be better teachers and push their students, but also, like Fawn said, let the students help push the teachers because they've now got these different tools that they can use and contribute to their own learning.
Right. Yeah, I think that there's, you know, as somebody that was in the classroom for 10 years, there's always that understanding and that knowledge that there is this, like, you know, there's this third space learning that goes on in digital spaces, right? And there's certainly, you know, I think I'm probably not the only person who during quarantine learned all about TikTok and other social media things that I perhaps was not necessarily engaged in before. But there's, you know, just absolutely fascinating ways that students are engaging with critical literacies, that young people are engaging with critical literacies. But there's also this, you know, tension between also this fear of the social media that students have and this fear of like the dangers that it can bring into the classroom. And this is sort of an off the cuff question, but do you any of you have any thoughts about how to sort of negotiate the like wanting to utilize the expertise that students bring while also as a classroom teacher being like, but I'm scared of what it can bring, right? I don't know, sort of.
Yeah, I'll jump in and try to tie it back to our previous comments here too. I think two things that I will say often in workshops and to colleagues when I'm coaching and mentoring is that number one, we still want kids to read poetry and stories and books. We still want them to put words into sentences, sentences into paragraphs, and paragraphs into essays and stories and other pieces of written composition. We're not throwing that out, okay? So number one, and you, as someone who has a bachelor's, possibly a master's, maybe even multiple master's degrees, are the expert in the room with those things. The other side of that, I would say, is that In contrast to the technology that we used to grow up with, where if you put the wrong floppy disk in or you pulled it out at the wrong time or you forgot to save, you'd lose your entire file or, you know, whatever. It is really hard for students to break something nowadays. So play, go in, tinker around in that Google Doc. And you know what? If you don't like it, hit the revision history. Go in, play, try to make a digital movie saved on the cloud. And if you mess it up, just hit the undo button. And I think that part of the challenge is allowing ourselves to not be experts and to say that I have a bit of a vision for you and I would like for you to try, but I don't know how to click every button. I don't know every feature. I don't know where everything is hidden in every menu. You need to be self-directed learners. And if you want to figure out how to make this transition between this scene and that scene in iMovie, I guarantee you 2,000 people have already posted about it on YouTube. Go look it up and find a 1-minute video that teaches you how to do this. But what I want to teach you is why you're making that transition in the first place. What is the larger message here? That's great. You can make a thing that looks like something that someone else did on TikTok. But why did you choose that framing of yourself in the video there? And then why did you switch to that angle? Why did you add this? Why did you add that? Those are the questions that we bring to the table. And we don't have to know every single button to push in the program or on the app. We just need to know the heuristics, the protocols, the ways to ask the questions of students so they can do that kind of good work. Mm.
An excellent point, and it segues really nicely into my next question, which is that for those of us who are involved in pre-service teacher education, do you have any suggestions about preparing them to teach and engage with digital literacies?
I think this goes back to what Troy mentioned about the National Writing Project ethos, right? That and tinkering and playing, like once they once they experience it within, you know, the context of what we're working on in building that expertise in the English language arts, they're much more able to see those connections because the technology is going to change, right? Mm-hmm. The tools are going to change. It's about what we do with those tools. And so I think experimentation is really important, trying it, having that space in the classroom to talk about it. And then also another point that came up in the conversation reminded me of the genre studies that we had students do around the modes and the media that they were choosing and kind of decomposing it. And we do a lot of that in our work in English language arts too, with texts, right? With literary texts. We've learned how to really look at what an author or a composer is doing with those texts and decompose it that way. I don't know. I just feel like there's, once we start playing with it, there's a lot of overlap between what we already do and how we're preparing our teacher educators. We just have to give them the space to do that and then to make meaning with each other around it.
One thing I was thinking of, and actually it was Fawn that helped me do this, was in a couple of my classes is having the student or the teachers think outside the box. And like one of the projects that we did was a multimodal. I give very little description of this project, and it comes directly from Fawn. She was the one that came and helped me with my class with this project. And I give them like a idea, but I tell them to go play, go experiment, use what you have, but then try something new. Get out of your comfort zone. And I'm not grading on that exact product. I'm looking at like, what did you do? How innovative, or how much did you explore? How did you get out of your comfort zone as a teacher? Because your students are gonna possibly know how to do this better than you, but just pushing them to like think about, because they want this rubric and these directions laid out. And we don't do that. I mean, for this project, the pushback that I got, and it was for my pre-service and my in-service that did this. And so it's helping them to see, you know, how to make themselves better also. And I think that goes off of like what Fawn and I have done and worked with in these projects. And this is something else, a different class even.
Yeah, I would just pick up on what Chilla said there. I think 99 out of 100 pre-service teachers are the kids who played the game of school really well. Mm-hmm. You always have the one who actually didn't like school and wants to go into teaching to make change and all that, which is good. We really like those kids. You know, it's those 99 that are looking for the checklist, the rubric. This is what I did. This is how I succeeded. This is the, you know, and again, I'll go back to my point I made a moment ago. We still want kids to read books. We still want kids to be able to write full coherent pieces of, you know, an essay or a story or something like that. And yet helping our pre-service educators see there's other possibilities here. There are different ways to think about this. And I think then, you know, to go to your larger point, Merida, about like, yeah, okay, you can get on TikTok. Great. Are you watching, what are you watching on TikTok? Like, are you watching, well, like, I believe her name is Sarah Cooperman, who is doing these lip syncs of the president and engaging in a critical stance through humor? Or are you just watching someone dancing again for on repeat the 15th time? And not to say there's not interesting things to think about and deconstruct and model and emulate from a dance video on TikTok, but it's not only, you know, what we're watching, it's how we're watching as well, and the level of criticality, I guess, you could bring to that task. And then also, I think the other thing with pre-service teachers, the thing that I've started to move toward more in my classes, I don't know the exact percentage, but I would basically say that about 80% of the stuff that I have them do, the things that I have them do, are pass-fail. Make an attempt, give it a go, I will give you feedback on it, and it's pass-fail. You either do it or you don't do it, go. And then there's that 20% where, yeah, you need to put in some effort and there's probably going to be some revisions and some changes and you might not get an A, you might get an A minus or a B plus. But I think also kind of changing our structures and the ways that we set out assignments, using a lot of universal design principles, providing them with choice, showing them models, giving them opportunities to fail forward and to get feedback and not feel like they're going to lose the grade. I think that's a big part of it. Because again, they played the game of school really well. That's why they ended up in teacher education and why they want to go back to the classroom. We need to honor that without completely, you know, turning them off and be like, oh, why am I doing this? What is it? Because that's the other big thing, right? Pre-service teachers say, well, there was no connection between my methods class and then what I actually experienced in school. Like, we don't want to make that disconnect even wider. We actually want to narrow that gap and help them understand that they could do something a little bit different.
Can I add really quick, Troy, onto something that you keep iterating about? We still want them to read, we still want them to write and, you know, make sentences and build paragraphs, those kinds of things. One of the things that we saw in what students did in these digital self-portraits that they designed was that they are using all of those things that they've learned throughout every year of their English classes, right? That's still really important foundations for what they do in TikTok. They're just not always aware that they're doing those kinds of things. It made me think of how we worked through that process also. Hmm.
Interesting. You know, I'm thinking about the great value of, you know, teaching our pre-service teachers, which I think is a hard lesson for everybody to learn who goes into education, right? Troy, you had said earlier of not feeling like we don't have to be experts, right? And letting go this sort of feeling that we must be the experts, right? And I know that, you know, Fawn and Chilis, you had both talked about the importance of bringing in our students' expertise, right? And then also the important sort of voice in our pre-service teachers' heads that we can be, that is like, you're fine, you're doing fine, right? Which I know you had all mentioned earlier, working with teachers in the classroom, of, you know, having that person behind you going like, you can do it, you're doing a great job. And sort of how valuable both those things in our heads at the same time are in order to like move into sort of unknown spaces, right? And digital literacies, I think for a lot of, you know, educators often feels like new and unknown spaces. So my last question is, and I know that everybody touched a little bit on this in the midst of our discussion, and so perhaps it's just, do you have anything you want to add to, you know, what you think 2021 and beyond is going to look like in K-12 schools, and I guess even higher ed, after our sort of experiences with virtual learning that we've had over the course of 2020? Or any hopes for what we could be doing?
I think I'm really liking... So the other day I stumbled across, I had printed it out at some point and I was digging through stuff, the NCTE's Students Write to Their Own Language, right? And thinking about the ways that digital literacies can open up spaces for students to show what they're learning in different kinds of ways and on their own terms. And I don't know. And I think that it will also, hopefully we'll have more space to interrogate all of those other, you know, business as usual kinds of things that just because we, you know, had been going, you know, we had this, you know, just keep going the status quo. Now that it's been disrupted, I think we have a real opportunity to rethink what we're doing.
I'll just tag on to that. I think it's important because, like you're saying, it's altered or the changes that have been made. But I would hope that we don't digress, that we don't, like Troy had said, access, that we don't take for granted what we've done to help our students grow in the past year, digitally or alternatively or however. I would hope student teachers or students themselves, I would hope that we wouldn't go, okay, now let's go back this way. I would hope we'd continue to move forward and give those students the access that they need. And like our huge district here providing devices and tools to every child in our district, you know, 135,000, like, you know, what are we gonna do? How do we do this? So I think it's important that my hope is that we continue to move forward through what we've been through.
Yeah, make it more permeable, right? The classroom, like the elephant in the room, I think today is, you know, Black Lives Matter and, you know, the presidential election and all of these things that we tend to think happen outside. It makes it more permeable too. Mm-hmm. We have these spaces where digital literacies invite all of these other resources that we use every day into the classroom.
I promise I will get to the hope. I'll say my one kind of pessimistic worry here too. Like, I feel like one of the challenges in talking with teachers from my own writing project and with other teachers through like NCTE's virtual conference last week and in other spaces is that this phrase of remote learning or virtual learning or online learning, it's always been a little weird, right? Like, do you mean like a correspondence course where I kind of log in and I turn in my assignment and my teacher may get back to me in a couple days? Are we talking about synchronous real-time video instruction? Are we talking about some other combination of this? And we need to come to terms with the terms, if that makes sense. I think that, you know, even as I look at my own children's district and the districts around us, what counts as remote learning is very different. You know, my kids are on Zoom at 7:47 in the morning. Some of their teachers are logging off by 7:53 and saying, good luck with your assignment. And others are on there the whole time. And then in other districts, they may have a schedule where they're in Zoom class or Google Meet or whatever for Monday and, you know, Thursday, and then their other classes are Tuesdays and Fridays, and Wednesdays is a fully asynchronous day with office hours and things like that. So all of that is to say that I know it's going to be contextual and everybody has, you know, the right and the privilege within their own districts to make those decisions, but I hope we start to talk a little bit more fluently about what it could be. But then the hopeful piece, yeah, I would echo what Chilis and Fawn said. I feel that the devices are there, the teachers want something, the kids want something, they know that there's opportunities to do things that are more critical and creative and timely and engaging. And, you know, if ever a time, what other time is there than now? Because we can teach the kids, here's how you get news from multiple sources. Here's how you analyze and read these sources. Here's how you put them in conversations with novels and poetry and stories. Here's how we have a discussion. Oh, we're not in class today. Let's move to Flipgrid. No problem. It's already set up. Let's go. And I think this kind of flexibility that teachers are going to be able to build from and utilize, we have to build on that as a strategy. Like, we know we're going to be toggling back and forth and moving here and there. And sometimes people are in real time and sometimes they're anytime. Let's just embrace it and take advantage of it. How can, without completely overwhelming ourselves and trying to plan 25 lessons for one class period, how can we embrace different technologies and opportunities for students to connect and be in community with one another across time and space? And I think that's the new conversation for virtual learning.
Wonderful, wonderful. I really love that we're sort of ending thinking about the ways that digital learning increases community, right? And I really think that I've noticed that with my own child, who's 5 and already at least as good at Zoom as I am at this point. So thank you, all three of you, for speaking with me today. It was really a pleasure to chat with you all.
Thank you.
And listeners, to read this manuscript, check out Jolly's Fall 2020 issue, which is to be published in mid-December. All right. Thank you all, and have a wonderful day.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Bye, everyone.
Bye.
Bye.